Okay, I wanted to play a piece of video, which is Julia Hartley Brewer interviewing Laura somebody, and I can't remember her name. Let me just check. Laura Dodsworth. Okay, so it's a piece of Julia Hartley Brewer on talk radio interviewing Laura Dodsworth, who's a journalist. She's written a book, and it's about the propaganda, the behavioral psychology, and the government's nudge unit, which is the propaganda arm of the COVID response. I can't even say these things, but that's what it is. So I want to play the whole piece. I think it's about 15 minutes, something like that. 10 minutes, just over 10 minutes.
So let's talk about, well, sort of how we got here, really, I suppose, with my next guest. That is Laura Dodsworth. She's a journalist and photographer. She's also author of a brand new book called A State of Fear, How the UK Government Weaponised Our Fear During the COVID Epidemic. Good morning to you, Laura.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, this book, I was seeing you online talking about this. Now, you've been someone who's been campaigning against lockdowns and certainly urging the easing at the earliest possible opportunity. You decided to write this book because you were hearing from sources that actually, you know, so much of what has happened in the last year has been as a result of scaremongering and overplaying threats and people being, frankly, terrified out of their minds and terrified into their homes. And even with the relaxations that we've had in April and this month and next month, millions of people really too scared to actually take part, you know, to go to the theatre, to go to a cinema, to go on holiday, and saying, oh no, they're just not willing to do it, even after they've been vaccinated. And you've put this down to what, to all intents and purposes, has been propaganda. What have you discovered?
Yeah, it's so interesting today, isn't it? This is the day when restrictions are being relaxed, and it should be a day for celebration. But, you know, at the same time, there's this widespread suspicion that the latest modelling, which was released from Sage, which had some quite extraordinary predictions for hospitalisations and deaths this summer, and also the talk about so-called variants like the Indian variant, are actually psychological nudges to encourage us to keep following the rules, to keep fear levels high, even if it's supposedly for our own good. So I think the story of the last year would look on the face of it to be about an epidemic. But for me, my journalistic investigation took me into a completely different story, which is a story of fear. Behavioural psychology is now very deeply embedded in government. It's how the government does things. It's how they get us to change our ways, to become model citizens and to follow rules. And one of the big learnings for me in this book is not just how they've used fear supposedly in our best interests to make us follow lockdown rules, it's how much behavioural psychology is part of how the government relates to us.
Yeah.
There was a really extraordinary document that was released last year, dated March 22nd, where the behavioural scientists who report into Sage and the government said that some people were too complacent because they understood that the risk of death was low for their age. And so what they recommended doing was raising the sense of threat for everybody to encourage us to follow the rules.
But this was an open admission. This was members of the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Behaviour, SPIB, is that how we pronounce that? They were officially asked, you know, how do we go about trying to change people's behaviour? What do we need to do to get people to go along with this? And there was this real concern, we know from former, you know, other Sage minutes that we've seen from last year, that their view was that we wouldn't get enough people conforming to lockdown. And as it was, when we did actually finally go into lockdown, the 23rd of March, actually there was far more compliance than the government had ever not just predicted, but indeed had ever wanted, in terms of basically every business closed down unless it was an absolute essential. Everyone was staying at home, and they predicted, I mean, people kept their kids away from school, even though they were key workers and the like, and it was a much bigger level of compliance than ever expected. And a lot of this is down to the tactics that were used, which you've in your book likened to sort of wartime levels of propaganda.
Absolutely. And actually, that martial language started in what I call Fright Night, the night that Boris Johnson gave his speech to the nation. I've gone back and I've analysed the language and also his body language with a couple of body language experts. And it was very martial. You know, it really evokes the Blitz spirit. That's not just about a kind of a we're in it together thing, but also war is a bitter pill. You know, you have to take your medicine. It's about obeying. It's about doing your part. So it really started then. And, you know, we've heard it called the China virus, or that it's the greatest threat in peacetime. There's a lot of warlike language, actually, which is partly to convey the severity of the threat, but also to make people knuckle down. Yeah. And again, you know, do their part to be good little soldiers. We've counted the fallen all the way through, except this time we were the fallen. Normally the death counts are at, you know, the end of war, but we've been doing it on a daily basis, which of course is part of the doom mongering.
Almost hourly. And you can almost see the disappointment on BBC and Sky and others when they announce when it's, I mean, again, any death is very sad of anything, not just COVID. And, you know, some days we have, you know, 4 deaths announced or 11 deaths announced. And you can almost hear the disappointment in their voices because, oh, it's not very high today. And yet they're still reporting it. But of course, they don't report all the deaths from cancer and untreated heart disease and the suicides and the like. But this is the interesting thing. This wasn't that our population became very, very scared from a terrible, terrible threat of a virus that was killing. We've seen excess deaths. This was and is and will remain a real virus that does kill. Let's not pretend it's not serious. But it was totally and deliberately overblown. So while there was and remains a serious risk to people who are elderly or frail or vulnerable, and I was always concerned for my family members, my older family members, and for anyone else, you know, in our society who's vulnerable, it was never a big risk to children, to teenagers, people in their 20s or 30s, and frankly, to someone healthy in my age bracket, their early 50s, not a particularly big risk either. I was pretty ill for 3 weeks, but certainly well enough, certainly to work from home during that time, and most of the people I know who've had COVID have recovered just fine, thank you very much, just still can't taste a few different foods, and frankly, consider that to be not the biggest problem in their lives. But they want, the government set out, and the scientists set out, to make us all as equally frightened, despite the fact that our risks were not remotely equal.
Well, this is not an uncommon thing these days in public health. There's a democratisation of risk. They want everybody to feel at risk. And like you, I do not want to refute that COVID is a serious disease. I set that out right at the beginning of the book. This isn't a conspiracy theory, but COVID's a real virus, a disease, and it's made people ill. But the point is, they wanted everybody to feel at risk to make us follow the rules. This paper, this Spy B paper, wouldn't have existed without the question. And the question is based on the government's fears. People won't follow the rules. I interviewed Spy B advisors for the book, and one of them said, we didn't know how people would react to not be able to go to the pub or not be able to go to football. And actually, this is interesting. There's a very classist thing here. It's like, how will those people cope without those things they do? And there's lots of ways that they did it. You know, we talked about the death figures. Well, like you just said, Julia, they were given without the context that about 1,600 people die every day in the UK on average, and more people die in the winter. The biggest numbers have always floated to the top like cream in the news. Yep. So whether it's cases or hospitalizations or deaths, whatever's the most dramatic news comes to the top. Yep. The data is also lumpy. So on a day when a bigger number die, maybe because of a delay in death registrations, that number gets quoted, but never the smaller number the day before. Also, the advertising. I mean, when you look back at it and review it, it's really easy to see in hindsight what was happening. It's often black and white, very grainy, a little bit like an upscale Blair Witch Project. Lots of use of yellow and black chevrons, like disaster cordons or wasps. Yeah. Do not cross. Danger. This will hurt. The use of statistics and modelling. I just referred to the SAGE report. You know, I think their mid-range report is that there'll be 10,000 hospital admissions per day in mid-July. And this frankly makes no sense. You know, all the vulnerable will be vaccinated and we'll be in the midst of summer when respiratory diseases are not abounding.
Yeah, I mean, but yet that data is taken seriously in government.
Well, I think what the problem is that ultimately people do not want to live in a state of fear, and they do not want to be manipulated.
I don't agree with you. I think a lot of people have, for want of a better word, it doesn't fall quite right, enjoyed on some level being part of something. There was a wonderful camaraderie in the first few months, well, first few weeks at least, last year, wasn't there? And people were all in together. But again, people thought it was just be for a few weeks, and then the fear set in, and then people got used to not having freedoms, yeah. and seemed to think that anyone who was enjoying any freedom at all was automatically going to kill 10,000 old people. But there are now so many people who are so afraid. They've gone from sort of enjoying the camaraderie to just genuinely being fearful leaving their homes. Is the people skulking along the street wearing a mask still after being double vaccinated?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a few things I'd say in response to that. First of all, the book is not just an expose of interviews with government advisors and psychologists. I've also interviewed people who've been impacted by fear. That was really important to me. So I've interviewed people who have developed agoraphobia, OCDs, self-harm, attempted suicide as a result of this campaign of fear and the anxiety and loneliness caused by lockdown. So really, not everybody's enjoying this. But yes, I hear you. There are some people who may have actually had some improvements in their life as a result of lockdown. And there is also something about fear. Look, some people like scary roller coasters and films, and it does do something to you, and it does do something to the body. And I've also explored these theories and interviewed people about that in the book. But overall, people do not want to be manipulated. And the problem with the kind of worst-case scenarios and the constant egging up of variants is that people lose trust in the government and in public health messaging. And that's very dangerous long-term to the government brand.
And very dangerous to the scientists as well. There's also this pretense that there is just one, the science, as opposed to many different dissenting views. And when people who have a dissenting view based on data are then threatened with losing their job and... we're in very dangerous territory indeed. It's a brilliant book. It's a really brave book. Laura Dodsworth, I really appreciate you joining us. So her book is called A State of Fear, and it is out.
Okay.
Hi, Britton.
Let's pause that for a second. I don't know whether I want to go through this, but this is the Dark Horse podcast. Let me just have a look at it, and I'll introduce it. 2 seconds. Yeah, why not? It's a Dark Horse podcast, and it's a conversation about whether COVID vaccines have long-term effects or not. So I'm just going to let that play. Again, it's about 10-15 minutes long. I'll just let it play. We'll get everything on the record, and then we'll take it from there.
Heather, I had a discussion with my pharmacy student brother regarding the long-term effects of the vaccine. He claimed that COVID vaccines can't have long-term effects. How valid is that assertion? Love you guys. Well, the vaccines are brand new. We cannot possibly have long-term data on what the long-term effects might be. Therefore, the claim that there can't be any long-term effects is absurd. We are in no position to know that.
Right. In fact, I have no idea what logic would even
suggest. You can't get there.
Right. I mean, the fact is different vaccines have different effects. And the very fact that this one interacts with the immune system, let's put it this way.
I mean, broccoli has long-term effects.
No, I think we can do even better than that.
Yeah.
Immunity to COVID is a long-term effect. Game over. They have long-term effects. What is the extent of the long-term effects? We don't know. Will some of them be negative? We don't know. Mm. We can't know. Right. Okay. They have long-term effects. One of the long-term effects.
I mean, that may just be a shortening of it to fit in the character limit. You know, negative long-term effects.
Oh, I have no
long-term side effects.
I have
effects.
No doubt that that's what's being said. But right. My point is, logically speaking,
we know that the whole point is that there will be long-term effects.
Right.
And for the claim to be yes, we understand this is brand new, but certainly all of the effects are in the we hope for it category as opposed to the we hope not for it category. Well, that's exactly what it sounds like. It's wishful thinking. And, you know, I hope we all get our wish.
We all wish.
We really do. But it's a logical fallacy, and it's creating exactly the thing we were talking about in the entire first hour and a half. Right.
I will also say, the possibility of reprogramming of innate immunity a possibility that has been discussed by Garrett Vandenbosch on Dark Horse. It's been discussed by others. This is one avenue that needs to be monitored, and it seems to be it's quite plausible that that will be among the long-term effects. The question really is, what's the full list and how common are they? A cat has just attacked a bug on the screen and knocked herself off the windowsill.
Window screen. Not. It would have been more fun for everyone if she'd been doing it on the Dark Horse screen.
Yes, true.
I think that part, not me, the questioner, I think that part of the hostility towards alternative solutions stems from sunk costs. The person adopted a bad idea that will ultimately hurt them, and they can't backtrack, so they double down hoping they're right. One possible solution might be to frame it as, I agree it's a problem. Here's a better solution than that, and here's why it's better, giving them a path of redemption and hopefully and hope that they're not completely screwed. I agree that this is going to be a big part of the dynamic when you're interacting with individuals. But the hostility towards alternative solutions was created by a bigger system. And you know, what part of what we're trying to do is figure out not just how to engage people who come at us with, how could you be possibly talking about an alternative treatment as opposed to vaccines, but how did we end up here? How did we end up in a situation a year on after a viable treatment was there was testimony before Congress about ivermectin as a viable treatment, and you're still not allowed to talk about it. Like that, the still not allowed to talk about it is being forced not just by individuals, but by the big things, by big tech and big media, and presumably by big pharma.
Yeah, I do think that there's something important in this question, which is, okay, we all faced a pandemic. We most of us thought a vaccine was far enough out that we were going to be without a response to it. And I certainly felt that before I understood what the evidence on ivermectin was.
Yep.
And so the point is, I think many people had momentum towards vaccine.
Uh-huh.
And then when they heard the vaccine had such promising numbers in terms of preventing COVID, it was like, oh, thank goodness, maybe this is going to be over. Maybe I won't have to, live in fear. And then there was this campaign that basically amounted to, oh, the good people will all get their vaccine because that's their duty to the collective. And again, were we to know a great deal more about the safety of these things and were they actually safe, which I hope they are, then I do believe that there is an obligation to take your tiny part of the risk in order that we could reach herd immunity and banish this pathogen. But I don't think that's remotely where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So nonetheless, people responding to that logic rushed to get the vaccine. The discussion about the actual potential for harm, the responsible discussion, is late emerging for some of those people who've been vaccinated, either under pressure or because it seemed maybe safer than it is. And having done that, knowing people as we do, a large fraction of people will respond to the cognitive dissonance of the comparison between what they thought the safety profile was and what it actually is, largely being about the unknowns, and they may double down.
This is true. This just feels like the easy part of it to me. Like I feel like interacting with individuals, as much as I came home very thrown by this interaction I had with this doctor. I didn't talk about half of what was in that conversation and how many just falsehoods are being thrown at me. But it's the systemic stuff. It's the populational stuff. It's the corporation level narrative that is being driven that is so much more difficult for individuals to fight back against.
Yeah, but there is the emergent explanation for that behavior. It's on the outside, is that we have no idea what the conversation sounds like on the inside, and it almost never sounds like
they're not supervillains.
Right, they're not supervillains. Yeah. These are normal, mostly good people who reach conclusions that they actually think are sound, that they in part think are sound because they find ways to edit out the things that would tell them you're actually making an error.
Yeah.
And so, that arrogance then gets compounded compounded by the normal human feeling of wanting to feel good about a decision you've made rather than bad. So if you've, you know, gotten vaccinated or gotten your family vaccinated and then, you know, you start hearing discussion that doesn't sound like crazy people and they're talking about safety concerns that you don't know the answer for because they really amount to, yeah, we don't know yet.
Yeah.
It may well cause people to try to shut down discussion in part because they don't want to keep being reminded that they have now taken something and they're not going to know for a long time.
All right, that was the Dark Horse podcast. I think it was one of the more recent ones. It's Brett Weinstein and Heather Hayes. I think I always get the name wrong, but it's the Dark Horse podcast anyway, which you can find on Podbean and you can find on YouTube. You can find it pretty much everywhere. They haven't been banned from YouTube yet, but they're always in fear of being banned when they talk about ivermectin and things like that. But it's good. It's a good source of information as far as I'm concerned. It's one of my go-to places, and I recommend that you subscribe to that one and the Highwire. If you haven't already got a subscription going to the Highwire podcast, there's the free version, and then you can sign up as a supporter if you like what they're doing. I haven't done that, but I like their free stuff. And it's got some sound science backing it up. It's not there is some speculation in there. There are some Christian assumptions in there because it's American. But if you discount the Mark of the Beast stuff, which I do, there is still good science in there as well. And that's what I'm interested in. It's connecting the dots with science and with good assumptions that will produce an end result that makes sense, a prediction that makes sense about what's coming next, and then we can start working on what we do about it. So there was a guy called Fleming on the Highwire a couple of weeks ago, Richard M. Fleming, who had a very, very good analysis of what's been going on. So I recommend you listen to that. Anyway, that's enough from me for the time being. We've gone 20 minutes, and I got in what I wanted to get in pretty much. I'll do another one of these tomorrow. Now that I've got a format sorted out for videos and I know how to do it, without it being live, it's fine. Now that I know how to do it, I'll do it a bit more.